Today is September 14th. It's Sunday morning. It's the 14th of Elul. Halfway through Elul towards Rosh Hashanah. And we're learning Mishnah. We're finishing up the seventh perek of Masechet Brachot. We'll just take really 2 or 3 minutes to remind ourselves of some things we learned last week in the fourth Mishnah of the seventh perek of Masechet Brachot. And those of you who have the photostat from Professor Albeck's Mishnah, it's at the bottom of page 27, the last line of the Mishnah there. Again, it's the fourth Mishnah of the seventh perek of Brachot. And the Mishnah says, this is last week's Mishnah, right? Shlosha shachlu ke'echad, three that ate is one, einan rashayin lechalek, are not permitted to divide up. V'chein arba, v'chein, next page, chamisha. Right?
Hamisha.
Which means that so the law is for four, so it is for five, shusha nechlakin, ad asara, until ten. If you have three, you can't divide up. If you have four, you can't divide up. Five can't divide up. Six can divide up. And why? Because we said that if you have three, so less that wouldn't be a zimun. You can't divide up. If you have four, divide it to three and one, then one person is missing the zimun. Can't do that. Same thing with five. If you have six, they can divide it to three and three, not into four and two, but into three and three. And there it was important to remember that we might have thought they couldn't divide up, because we could have thought that Barov Am Hadrat Melech, we could have thought that in the multitudes is coronated the king, and we could have thought that a zimun of six is better than three and three. But still the halakha says, no, you're allowed to divide up. Apparently all you need is the minimum zimun of three. And if you can have that in two different groups, then that's fine. You don't need the group of six. Adasara. Same thing if you have seven or eight or nine, you can divide up as long as you say in two groups or three, as long as everyone is in a group of at least three. Right? But asara, you can't divide up, because here we have another formula of zimun, another level, another qualitative level. If you have ten, you can't divide up to nine and to six and three, or three, three and three, because you have that zimun of ten, which is important not to lose. And we pointed out last time that phrase ad, that word ad, until ten, well, in principle, the word ad can be understood in two different ways. Not here, but in principle, that word, it could be ad va'ad bichlal, which means up until and including, or it could be ad below ad bichlal, up until and not including. So here, when it's ad asara, which is it? Is it ad va'ad bichlal, or is it ad below ad bichlal?
Low.
It's low, right? Because it says that chen arba v'chen chamisha shisha nechlakim, so six are allowed, seven, eight, nine, but ten's a different law. So ad asara, you can divide up, but not asara, ad v'lo ad bichlal. Then we learn, ba'asara inan nechlakin, ten can't divide up, just like we said, ad shi usrim, until there are 20. If you have 19, you can divide up, but what am I saying, the opposite, right? If you have 20, you can divide up in two and two. Ten, two of ten. But if you have 19, then you can't divide up, because one of the groups would be missing its zimun of asara. Last week we worked on the connection between this Mishnah and the first Mishnah of the Perek. Because this one began, Shlosha shachlu ke'echad einan rashayin lechalek, and the first Mishnah of the Perek said almost the same thing in different language. It said, Shlosha shachlu ke'echad chayavin lezamen. What's the difference between chayavin lezamen on the one hand and einan rashayin lechalek? And we gave some answers within our learning. We saw in the Gemara three different answers to that. And I just want to point out what we said, that according to Professor Albeck in his notes at the back of his volume, that we have to remember that it just might be that the question's not a question. The relationship between Mishnah Aleph and Mishnah Dalet might not be an issue. Because if we understand, which is historically true, that the Mishnah is made up of Kfatzei Mishnayot, of collections of Mishnayot from different Batei Midrash that were collected by Rebbe Dan Asi, he did not necessarily make an effort to smooth it all out and make sure there's no superfluity. It could be that one Beit Midrash had a Mishnah that Shlosha Shachlu Ke'echad Chayvim Lezamen, and it went on from there. And another Mishnah Shlosha Shachlu Kehad Inan Rashim Mechalek, and went on from there. And the truth is that the beginning of both of those Mishnah really do say the same thing. The Rabbi there, Anasi, included them both in our collection that he made because he wanted to include full units from the Batei Midrash, and the continuation of each of those units was important for him, so he kept in the beginning also. That might be, which would mean that the Gemara's questioning of what do you need Mishnah Dalet, if you already have Mishnah Dalet, is not a question. It's a straw man. Ah, did the Gemara not know what we know, but the structure of the Mishnah and how it's collected? And Professor Albeck suggested that perhaps the Mishnah knew no less that the Talmud knew no less than us. And asked the question of the connection between Aleph and Dalet, not because it really thought that it was a serious textual question, bipshat, rather because it was using that issue, which is really not an issue, using an issue as a kind of mnemonic, or as a pin the tail and donkey, as a way to pin rabbinical halachot, other rabbinical halachot, on the Mishnah, even though it knew that those halachot are really not a function of what's written in the Mishnah itself. And he said that's just like the rabbis of the Mishnah behave towards the Torah itself sometimes. They use the Torah as a basis to pin onto it their own rabbinical halachot, even though they knew that that's really not the pshat of the psukim. They didn't mean it to be the pshat. They meant to do a asmachta. Remember that word, asmachta? The language of leaning it on the verse. Asmachta, the language of somech or smicha, which means to lean. Smicha, laying on of hands, is when the rabbi leans his hands on his student and passes on the tradition of authority. Or when you do smichan korbanot, you lay your hands on the korban to transfer your identity onto the animal itself in a symbolic sense. So the word smicha means to lean on, to transfer. And asmakta is when we lean a certain halakha on an earlier source, even though we really know that that's not the source of our halakha. It could be the Tanaim leaning a source, leaning a halakha on the Sukkim, or it could be the Amoraim leaning a halakha on the Mishnah.
The thing is, though, what bothers me about that idea is that for the Tanaim doing that for Sukkim from the Torah, you could say, well, there was Torah Sebaal Peh was oral. They needed some help in recall, and it was therefore a benefit memory-wise to make that connection. Here, if everything's being written down, why you don't need any memory benefit. So there's no, you'll write it down one way or the other, whether you connect it to a particular verse or not. So why bother doing that?
So two answers to the question. One is that it's not clear at all that Jewish society became a written society so quickly. Just like we know, seems to be, that when the Mishnah was edited in the year 200, it was edited orally, and it wasn't written down. The same goes with the Talmud. The discussions of the Talmud on the Mishnah weren't written down for a long time after they occurred. And of course, even after Talmud was finally written down as a final document, perhaps let's say it's not clear, the document as we have it, perhaps the year 700, perhaps the year 600, even then, who actually owned a copy of it? Right? It was oral study for many, many, many centuries, to a large degree.
We see lots of mnemonics in the Gemara.
Right, right.
It occurs all the time.
And that was
explicit mnemonics. Mm.
And the second answer, I said it's going to give two answers, that it's not just a mnemonic. It's also of the very essence of a traditional society, that innovation has to be connected to the past. I mean, we see it all the time. When a rabbi gives a sermon, right? Very often, in some sense or another, it's connected to Parshat HaShavua. So he claims. Right? But is it really? Right? And that's the process of Darshanut. That tradition propagates itself and maintains itself through a sense of continuity, which is taken, this is hard to say, is taken partly seriously by those involved in it, whereas those looking from the outside would say there's really no connection. Like when the rabbi makes a sermon and learns something out from Parshat HaShavua, he kind of means what he says. He kind of really does see this based on the parsha in a very, very tenuous sense and creative sense. I'm generalizing. And us as listeners, caught up in and part and parcel of the fabric of a traditional society, we also see the connection to Parshat HaShavua. But an outsider listening to that tape, that drasha, in many cases would say, wait a second, you can understand that pasuk in five other ways, but the way you understood it has nothing to do with Pshuto Shel Mikra. But when you're involved in the process, when you're involved in the moment, you see the connection, and I think it's a very interesting psychological process.
We see that debate in the American judiciary.
Just in a certain sense.
There's people that imagine that the founders had a sense of certain rights that maybe they didn't elucidate, and they try to hang them on wording that suggest. And so people from the outside complain of those things. People say there's a right to privacy, and they see the wording that suggests that, but not... it's not...
Or that you can even be free to interpret the text. You know, why limit it to an original intent? You can
right. And I'm sure there are debates in the American legal system if a certain interpretation is an asmachta, or if it really is, or if the person, or if the interpreter really thought that it was. This is of the very essence of literary criticism, and again, all the more so in a traditional society that feels itself in the continuity from Sinai. Okay, so now we go on. We're in the last Mishnah of the Perek. Perek Shvi'i, Mishnah Hei. The Mishnah begins at the top of page 28 with the word Shtei Chaburot.
This is a separate Mishnah?
It's a separate Mishnah, right, Rabbi...
In this version, it's not labeled.
Yeah, it's not labeled, so it should be.
Okay.
Hey. The third line after it says Shayu Isrim, and then Shtei Chaburot, the hay of the new Mishnah fell out there. Okay, so Shtei Chaburot Shayu Uchlot Shavayit Echad. There's nothing that needs translating. Bizman Shemikzatan Ro In Elu Et Elu. So the word Mikzatan comes from the word Mikzat, which comes from the word Sat. What does the word Sat mean?
A little, a few.
Hare Elu Mitzarfim Lazimun. Vim Rav Elu Mizamnim Latzman. The Elu Mizamnim Latzman. Ein Mivrachin Alayayin. Ad Shiten Latocho Mayim. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. I'm sorry, Eliezer. Vachamim Amrim Mivrachin. Notice that this Mishnah is consistent in its use of the Nun and the Yud Nun at the end of words in order to create the plural, which means that we really have in this Mishnah the original text of Mishneiach Hebrew. We point out in the past that sometimes copyists in the Middle Ages would change the Nun to a Mem, thinking that the Nun was a mistake, or just out of the Shigra, just out of habit, without noticing it, because in the Mikra, in the Torah, and just about 95% of the Tanakh, the plural is made with a mem at the end. Whereas in Mishneiach Hebrew, it's with a nun, and this Mishnah has maintained its pristine form, whereas in some other Mishnah, we saw that copyists changed the nun to a mem. Oh, I'm sorry, there is one word, mitzarfim. That one word, mitzarfim, in the middle of the second line, is a mem at the end. It should be a yud. I'm sorry, a yud nun. Besides that one, all the others maintain their original form. Oh, I'm sorry, hachamim omrim. The second to last word is also with a mem. It should be hachamim omrim. But all the others, whether it's mikzatan, whether it's ro'in, whether it's mizamnin, it's mivrachin, they all maintain the original nun at the end. Okay.
It's going to be a different version, yeah. So you've got it.
Oh, you have from a different manuscript.
Mitzarfim in mine is Yud Nun.
Okay, so you have a better manuscript, that particular text.
You have the official version, right?
So that means I have to take my heart off to art, my hat off to art school?
That's 1 point for art school.
Goodness gracious.
All these times. Sorry.
Must be a pirated version.
It's a mistake.
Okay, so the question sheet should be pretty self-explanatory. There are 13 questions on the Mishnah. And the rest of the questions are on the other sources. Of course, I realize that most of the other sources are beyond the linguistic capabilities of most of us. We'll get to it when we get to. The Mishnah, of course, is the main thing. The later commentaries
and the Gemara plus of course. Why did they put water in the wine?
That's for you to think about and talk about.
Water in the wine?
Yeah.
It's actually they're putting wine in
water. Water was, in ancient times, was much heavier, wasn't it?
No, it was to make a